Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, and thanks to the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Council, who advised us that Dr. Jonathan Speier was in town. So he's just come back from a series of meetings with both sides of politics in Canberra. I'll introduce him very briefly. Our speaker was born in Britain, has lived for two decades in Israel. He's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Global Research at Herzliya in Israel. He's an author, a commentator, an analyst. He's written for many magazines and newspapers, including Haaretz in Israel and The Guardian in Britain. He obtained his PhD at the London School of Economics in Britain. And he recently went into both Lebanon, but in particular, of interest tonight is Syria. And the topic for tonight's talk is Syria, the Assad regime, and the rebels. Jonathan, very, very welcome. Thank you.
Thanks. Well, first of all, good evening, and it's very nice to get the chance to speak to you here in Sydney. And of course, it's a very topical and interesting time to be discussing Syria. So I hope we have plenty of chance to have a good discussion and questions and answers and so on afterwards. To get straight to it, what I want to try to do in this talk is four things. I want, first of all, to look at the current situation in Syria and the background to the uprising and where things currently stand. I want then to observe the balance of power as it currently is between the regime and the rebels. I want then to go on to look at the international support or absence of support for each of the sides. And finally, to attempt some speculation and a very small bit of advocacy regarding the chances for regime survival or, conversely, a successful toppling of the Assad regime. Regarding the current state of events, then, in Syria and the background to the uprising, the Assad regime, having declared itself immune from the Arab Spring in a famous interview by Bashar Assad, President Bashar Assad, into the Wall Street Journal on January 31st, 2011, in which he went into great detail as to why there had not been an uprising in Syria and why there would not be an uprising in Syria. Having declared itself immune from the Arab Spring, then, the regime was caught badly unawares by the outbreak of large-scale protests in the southern Syrian town of Dara in March 2011. And having made some rather ham-fisted, I think it's fair to describe it, attempts to placate the protesters. First of all, the sacking of the unfortunate Mr. Faisal Khaltoum, who happened to be the governor of Dara at the time when the uprising broke out. Then the granting of nationality to thousands of Syrian-born Kurds. Then the scrapping of a ruling banning teachers from wearing the Islamic niqab headwear. And finally, the rescinding of emergency laws in place since 1963. Having given out these fairly cosmetic concessions in the first weeks of the uprising, the regime in mid-April went into a frontal confrontation with the protesters. And this frontal confrontation, in essence, continues to this day. The confrontation then has been going on for now nearly 14 months. Between 11 and 12,000 people are dead. Tens of thousands have become refugees in Turkey and Lebanon. Unknown numbers are in regime custody. The pattern on the ground has now become clear and familiar. The revolt is taking place not throughout the entirety of the territory of Syria, but rather in certain specific areas of the country. The regime first places areas in revolt under closure and then moves to pacify them. The armed element among the rebels withdraws. The civilian population of the area in question is left to bear the brunt of the retribution that follows. But when the regime moves on, the rebellion reignites. Neither side can deliver a fatal blow to the other. The initiative in this ongoing contest has ebbed and flowed between regime and opposition in the course of the year. I'd like to observe some of the most important recent events. Starting in late 2011, following months of demonstrations and repression, the opposition and Free Syrian Army, the armed element among the opposition, began to establish precarious control over a number of areas of Syria. First to come under rebel control were a number of towns and villages in Idlib province, in the north near the Turkish border. Later in January 2012, the Free Syrian Army succeeded in taking control of the town of Zabadani in Damascus province, following intense clashes with the regime army. On the 21st of January, the FSA temporarily captured the town of Douma, near Damascus city. The Free Syrian Army also famously, and as people are aware, for 3 months controlled around two-thirds of the city of Homs, Syria's third largest city. And in January, some of Damascus's city suburbs also fell under partial and precarious opposition control. Once under rebel control, the regime effectively ceased to have any visible existence or presence in the areas in question. But this control was precarious in the extreme. The FSA admitted from the Free Syrian Army, admitted from the outset, that it was quite incapable of holding ground against frontal assault from the regime. This meant that it was clear that it was only a matter of time before the regime would move to retake these liberated zones. I spent in February a week in the liberated zone, as it was that time, since recaptured of Idlib province, which we can talk about in questions if people want to. In late February 2012, the regime began a concerted campaign to reconquer rebel-held areas. It began by retaking Douma, near Damascus. It moved on to Homs, famously with the shelling which killed the journalist Marie Colvin and her colleague, people are aware of. It then began the pacification of Idlib province, all in time for the beginning of the so-called ceasefire, the UN plan of Kofi Annan, scheduled to come into effect on April 10th, 2012. As described by Human Rights Watch in a recent document based on field research carried out in Idlib province prior to the ceasefire of April 10th, 2012, the regime's retribution in recaptured areas, often carried out by the Alawi irregulars, the Shabiha, so-called, who side with it, is extremely brutal and includes the summary execution of civilians. Human Rights Watch described how 95 civilians died and hundreds were wounded in the period between March 22nd and April 6th, as Syrian armor and infantry swept methodically through the towns of Sarmin, Sarakib, Taftanaz, Hazano and Keli. The report describes, for example, and people can find the report online, it's freely available, the execution of 19 members of a single family in their home, the Ghazal family of Taftanaz, on a single day, April 3rd of 2012. Similar actions have taken place throughout the country in areas affected by the uprising, in Homs, Hama, Idlib, Deir ez-Zor, Rastan, Dara, Dumane, Damascus, now, of course, famously in Hula in the last few days. The pacifications involve the use of helicopters, artillery, and armor against civilians, large-scale roundups, disappearances, and many deaths. But as has become apparent, the regime does not have sufficient wherewithal to place all areas in revolt under permanent occupation. So once again, when the armed forces move on, the uprising re-emerges. Syria is now in a state of civil war, with the two sides grossly mismatched and the outcome much depending on the international response. What of the opposing forces in this contest? Let's take a look first of all at the regime and then at the rebels that oppose them. The Bashar al-Assad regime has succeeded in maintaining the minimum key elements required for its survival. The political circle around the president has seen no major defections since the start of the uprising. No senior ministers, no army chiefs have yet gone over to the rebels. The Syrian Arab Army, that's the regime's, the official name of the regime's army, notionally numbers 280,000 troops in 12 divisions, plus an additional 280,000 reserves. But this army has been hemorrhaging troops from desertions since the start of the uprising and continues to do so. The problem, however, is that this regime does not require the entirety of its notional 280,000 men in order to defend itself and survive. Rather, certain forces, the Republican Guard, the famous 4th Armored Division of Maher Assad, the president's brother, the special forces, all of which are overwhelmingly Alawi in ethnic complexion and which are the best trained and equipped of all the units of the army, are the elements needed and used for active moves against the rebels. In addition to these divisions, the regime maintains a force of an estimated 60 to 70,000 armed Alawi irregulars, known as the Shabiha, the Arabic word for ghost, for those who are interested. The internal security forces and internal intelligence services also play a key role in maintaining the fear of the regime, at least in areas outside of the hotbed of the rebellion. And let me just outline in a little bit of detail, which I hope is of interest to people, that Syria has four internal security directorates: military intelligence, air force intelligence, state security, and political security. And these four directorates operate under the umbrella of a body called the National Security Council, headed by a Shia general, Hisham Ikhtiar, who reports directly to Assad. In total, they're thought to number at least 65,000 full-time employees, plus, of course, a vastly larger army of agents and informers. So Assad's security structures remain standing and in existence and active, and currently adequate for the defense and survival of his regime. In terms of its domestic standing, the regime maintains the support of the 12% Alawi minority, that is to say, it's the sectarian group to which the Assads themselves and their closest allies belong, in an uprising which is taking on increasingly sectarian overtones. Consequently, because of the growth of sectarianism, the 10% Christian minority and the 10 to 15% Kurdish minority have also stayed largely outside of the uprising. They don't want to get involved in what they regard as a battle between the Alawi regime and the Sunni Arab majority of the country. And Assad also depends and largely has, or to a degree, has succeeded in maintaining the acquiescence of the Sunni middle and merchant class in the key cities of Damascus and Aleppo. That acquiescence has partly frayed. Damascus and Aleppo are seeing demonstrations in growing numbers. It's frayed, but it's not yet broken as of now. The bottom line being then that the Assad regime, while severely stretched, shows no signs currently of collapse or of impending collapse. What of the rebels? The Syrian opposition has found difficulty in uniting, and a single opposition framework able to bring together the various disparate elements does not yet exist. The main external opposition body is the Syrian National Council, led until his recent resignation by former Sorbonne professor Burhan Ghalioun and headquartered in Istanbul, Turkey. Additional elements among the opposition which should be considered and which I'll briefly outline are the network of local coordination committees and revolutionary councils within Syria, loosely and problematically, by the way, associated with the SNC, Syrian National Council, the National Coordinating Body, which is a rival umbrella group to the SNC, and of course the armed element, the Free Syrian Army. In a little bit of detail then, with your permission, regarding the rebels in the opposition. The SNC was formed on August 23rd, 2011, as a coalition of seven opposition groups under Turkish tutelage and with a heavy presence of the Muslim Brotherhood movement in its ruling council. The SNC has been beset from the outset by claims, largely justified in my own estimation at least, that it represented no one inside Syria, and by additional claims that it was a front for the Muslim Brotherhood, and by internecine and endemic squabbling among its various constituent groups. It has failed to attract the membership of minorities, particularly the Kurds. It has failed to seal the loyalty of the Free Syrian Army, and it has failed to keep the loyalty of the local coordinating committees who joined it but are currently threatening to resign from it. Opposition politics, as usual, you may well be thinking to yourself. The SNB is a less significant body consisting of 13 leftist Syrian political parties, which opposes external intervention and maintains willingness for dialogue with the regime and its allies. It supports, it says, peaceful reform, and it is regarded consequently by other opposition groups as collaborationist with the regime. The uprising also, more importantly, has an armed element. The formation of the Free Syrian Army was announced in July 29, 2011, by former Air Force Colonel Riyad Assad. Despite the name and the notional command in Antakya, Turkey, this army consists for the most part of a loose conglomeration of armed initiatives centered around local power structures in parts of the country. The members of these structures include both recent army deserters and civilians who have decided to take up arms against the regime. A number of high-ranking officers have joined the FSA, including General Mustafa Ahmed al-Sheikh of the Syrian army, who joined on January 6, 2012, and at least one other general who is thought to have come over. The strategy of the FSA is evolving, at least according to statements by its officers and leaders. Initially holding to the modest goal of offering protection to demonstrators, al-Sheikh said in an interview on 12th January 2012, and I quote, "If we get 25,000 to 30,000 deserters mounting guerrilla warfare in small groups of six or seven, it is enough to exhaust the army in a year to a year and a half, even if they are armed only with rocket-propelled grenades and light weapons." This strategy was repeated to me in Antakya by a number of officers in interviews. It is, of course, highly questionable as to whether this strategy is workable, or indeed whether the FSA has the ability to pursue a coherent nationwide strategy of any kind, given the divisions within it. The FSA, which claims to number 70,000, probably has between 20,000, is active in certain parts of the country, the parts affected by the uprising. The largest concentration is in the central region, in Homs and Al-Hamra and the surrounding areas, with nine or more battalions thought to be active there. So the opposition has clear structures. It's determined, and it's proved that it's capable of absorbing blows and continuing. Still, it remains particularly stymied by the absence, the very glaring absence of unity. What of international response and assistance to the two sides? And here we see, in my estimation at least, the most glaring imbalance between the two forces arrayed against one another in Syria. The Assad regime has benefited and probably survived as a result of the firm and united backing of its international allies, above all Russia and Iran. Syria is a central member of the Iran-led regional alliance in the Middle East, and Iran is playing an active role in supporting its ally. Much evidence has emerged to indicate this. As early as April 14, 2011, US officials confirmed that Iran was aiding in the repression in Syria. State Department spokesman Victoria Nuland accused Tehran of providing the Syrian regime with know-how for monitoring and shutting down communications by activists. A classified United Nations report stated that Iran was covertly shipping arms to Syria in violation of international sanctions. The report listed six out of an alleged nine incidents in which Syria was the final destination of illegal arms shipments coming from Iran. One arms shipment, for your interest, intercepted by the Turkish authorities in March, contained, and I read from the list, 60 Kalashnikov rifles, 14 BKC machine guns, 7,920 rounds of Kalashnikov ammunition, 560 60mm mortars, and 1,288 120mm mortars. An Iranian opposition group, the Green Experts of Iran, reported that the Revolutionary Guards deployed a 65-man team along with four cargo planes loaded with arms to the IRGC operational base in Damascus. The report identified an IRGC commander called Jabari as leader of the IRGC mission in Damascus, etc., etc. I have a long list here and I won't torture you with going through all the details. Suffice it to say that in the public sphere there is a massive amount of available evidence indicating the active Iranian support for the regime in Syria. These allegations have been borne out both by eyewitness reports and by footage obtained of Iranians captured and held by the opposition. And this footage can be seen for anybody who has access to YouTube. It's freely available. Iranian aid to the regime has also taken financial form, with one source suggesting that $2 billion has been given to Syria over the last 2 years. And of course, Iran's allies and proxies, chief among them the Hezbollah movement in Lebanon, have also been mobilized to act as go-betweens and to actively aid the regime. Russia, too, has been aiding Assad overtly and covertly since the outbreak of the uprising. Russian support has been, of course, most telling and notable in preventing a coherent international response via the United Nations Security Council on Syria. Russian aid to the regime in terms of arms has also been substantial. Between 2007 and 2011, imports from Russia accounted for 78% of all Syrian arms imports, according to a recent study by the Stockholm Peace Research Institute. The second largest supplier of arms to Assad in that period was Belarus, which accounted for a further 17% of imports. What this means then is that 95% of Syrian arms purchases come either from Russia or from its satellite client regime in Minsk in Belarus, which of course does not decide its own independent arms policy. Russian companies are also heavily engaged in infrastructure projects and oil and gas exploration in Syria. Total investment by Russia in Syria amounted to a sum of $19.4 billion in 2009. Given all this, it's not hard to understand the scale of Russia's commitment to the survival of Assad. There is also a very significant and important strategic element behind Russian support for the regime. The naval base at Tartus gives the Russian Navy the capability to operate in the Mediterranean and thus to reach rapidly the Red Sea via the Suez Canal and the Atlantic through the Strait of Gibraltar. Russia has no immediately available alternative to Tartus, and if Assad goes, the base will go. The nearest next base which the Russian Navy can use is in Sevastopol on the Black Sea, of course with a far less advantageous position. So for these reasons, the Russians have been determined to keep Assad in place and have been aiding him systematically in both the diplomatic and the military realms. Armed ships loaded with weaponry for the regime are leaving the port of Oktyabrsk in southern Ukraine, crossing through the Bosphorus Straits to Limassol in Cyprus, and thence to the port of Tartus. Four such ships have reached Syria since the beginning of the year. This is the lifeblood of the Assad regime. So behind Assad stands a determined international coalition, pledged to keeping him in power by all means available. The Western response, despite verbal support for the opposition, has been, of course, very different in nature. The US administration clearly wanted and wants to avoid any direct involvement in Syria. As a result, throughout 2011, policy appeared rudderless, with Washington tentatively trying out a variety of options and then abandoning them. Not until August did President Obama even call on Assad to depart unequivocally. The US sought first of all to rely on Turkey. But Turkey made clear that while it was prepared to sponsor and domicile the opposition and the FSA on its territory, it would take no unilateral steps without UNSC, United Nations Security Council, sanction. US and EU sanctions were incrementally increased in the course of the year-long uprising, and along with the collapse of the tourism sector, for obvious reasons, in Syria, these have had a heavy impact on the regime. The economy is expected to contract -3% in the course of the coming year, but with the help of Iranian donations and Russian arms supplies, the regime does not seem to be about to run out of funds. Two abortive international plans, supposedly for international mediation, have been supported by the West. The first Arab League plan failed to call for Assad's replacement and saw a small number of Arab League observers, inserted into the country. These were led by a Sudanese general, Mustafa al-Dabi, who it later transpired was himself a suspected war criminal. They were withdrawn when the failure of the plan to impact on the reality of the situation became apparent. The second plan, currently in the process of failing, is the UN-supported Kofi Annan six-point plan. It's been in operation since April 10, 2012. The regime has ignored its provision for removing troops and armour from populated areas. It has ignored its provision for allowing free access to journalists to the territory of Syria. The plan itself contained no call for the removal of the dictator in order to enable it to pass through the otherwise inevitable Russian or Chinese veto in the Security Council. The bloodshed has continued apace. The 250 UN observers under the Norwegian General Robert Mood have proven quite powerless to stop it. The tepid nature of this Western response may now be altering to a degree. There is evidence filtering out, at least some of it reaching the media, specifically the Washington Post newspaper, which is a good source on this stuff, to indicate that the West and the Arab states, most importantly Saudi Arabia and Qatar, have realized that sponsoring the squabbling external opposition is leading nowhere. Instead, money and arms, if these reports are to be believed, are now being made available directly to elements within Syria. Saudi Arabia and Qatar are providing the funds and the weapons, and if the Washington Post again is to be believed, the American administration have people on the ground helping to identify elements that will receive these in Syria itself. Even if these reports are accurate, they pave the way for a long civil war with uncertain results, rather than the rapid removal of the dictatorship. The armed opposition, as I tried to outline earlier, remains loose and divided. The Saudis and the Qataris have little experience, to put it mildly, of successful support of insurgencies. Indeed, Riyadh's track record on this in recent years has been fairly poor, particularly when up against Iran-associated forces. And we can think of the events in Lebanon in May 2008. We want to look for a precedent where the Saudis and the Iranians proxies clashed head-on. Of course, they clashed head-on in West Beirut in May 2008, with the result that Hezbollah went through the Saudis' friends like a knife through butter in 48 hours and took over the city. The Muslim Brotherhood are also understood to be the recipients of much aid and to be engaged in gaining political power on the side of the insurgents through the channeling of money and resources to the armed groups. The disunity and local nature of many of the armed groups facilitates the building of influence through the channeling of arms and resources. It seems much less likely to facilitate the building of a coherent, united insurgency to conduct the war against the Assad regime. Let me then move to a number of conclusions before we can begin our discussion and questions. Syria's alignment with Iran and with Russia are the core of a successful regional policy. Through it, Damascus has magnified its local and regional influence and obtained an insurance policy against paying any price for its activities. It is now clear that this policy made sense in other ways too. Indeed, it is currently paying dividends. Syria's alignment with the regional axis led by Iran and its alliance with Russia represent Assad's best hope of survival. Western hesitancy to confront Iran and its allies and Russia is the crucial factor making possible the crackdown in Syria and hence the survival of the regime. How so? Let's look back for a moment to the trajectory of the Arab Spring of 2011. The pro-Western Arab authoritarian rulers, Bin Ali in Tunisia and Hosni Mubarak in Egypt, were forced aside by a combination of internal and subsequent Western pressure. Assad, by contrast, who is aligned with the coalition of anti-Western states and movements led by Iran, has faced only minor Western pressure. The Syrian dictator is thus currently getting away with murdering thousands of his people because of Western desire to disengage from the region, fear of Iran and its proxies, fear of Russia, and of course active Iranian and Russian assistance. The fall or weakening of the Assad regime in Syria would constitute a serious blow to Iranian regional ambitions. Its resurgence under the protective tutelage of Tehran, by contrast, would prove that membership of the Iranian alliance provides a handy guarantee for autocratic rulers hoping to avoid the judgment of their peoples. It may well be that Western commentary will prefer to ignore the power politics implications of this. It may be assumed, however, that regional leaders and elites will pay close attention to them. If Assad survives, it will mean that the Arab Spring in the main countries of the Arab world will offer a near-perfect lesson to regional political elites regarding who it is worth aligning with. Pro-Western Mubarak was abandoned and fell. Pro-Iranian Syria Assad, meanwhile, will have dug in, been helped enormously by his Iranian and Russian patrons, and prevailed. This will represent a major defeat for the West and its remaining allies in the Middle East region. Absent increased external pressure, Bashar is likely to survive, for quite a while at least. In any case, the effort to bring him down is likely to be a marathon rather than a swiftly concluded contest. There is little or no likelihood of military action of any kind from the West, but at the very least, other forms of pressure can, and here let me move to my little bit of advocacy that I promised you, can and should be applied. For example, increased covert support for the rebels, support perhaps for the establishment of a no-fly zone, a humanitarian corridor, or a no-heavy armor zone in Syria's north. Civil war, and on this I'll conclude, has begun in Syria. It should be obvious, this should be a truism, but for some reason when one listens to the statements of the international community and former heads of the UN and so on, you'll still hear the phrase used. William Hague used it, Kofi Annan used it. If this continues, Syria is on the edge of civil war. I have news for both gentlemen. Syria has been in a state of civil war for at least the last 6 months. It's time we first of all called the thing by its name. Civil war is underway in Syria. This war sees Iran and Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and to a much lesser extent the US, supporting one or another of the sides. It is a war with increasingly sectarian overtones. It looks like having a long time to run. It has already consumed anywhere up to 12,000 lives. Its outcome will be of vast importance for the reasons I've tried to outline, not only for the people of Syria, but also for the future balance and strategic direction of the Middle East as a whole. On that, I will now be quiet, and I'll be very happy to take your questions. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, and so we come to questions and discussion. Our speaker's gone exactly 30 minutes, so we've got until no later than 7 o'clock to, for our period of discussion, so there's plenty of time. Thanks for a very important and easily understandable presentation for what's a very complex topic. You've just come back, as I mentioned earlier, from discussions in Canberra with senior figures in the Labour government and the Conservative opposition here, and as you know, our Foreign Minister Bob Carr yesterday announced that we were expelling two senior diplomats from the Syrian embassy in Canberra. I know that Israel's not involved in this conflict in Syria. It's not really Israel's business. But how does Israel view the regime? I mean, what's the attitude of the Israel government, if it does have an attitude, to what's going on there?
Thanks for the question. It's a question which needs a little bit of time to answer, because there's no simple answer to this. The short version is that the position of the Israeli government, or I would say the Israeli policy-making elite, and most specifically the security elite, very influential policy-making in Israel, has shifted 180 degrees since the beginning of the Syrian uprising. Prior to the beginning of the uprising, the prevailing opinion you would find among senior Israeli security people and policy people was that the Assad regime was in many ways an asset for Israel. The way you would hear it phrased would be the following. They would say, well, Bashar on the first hand is quite weak, contrary to appearances, because he rules only on the basis of a wafer-thin legitimacy of 12%, the Alawis of the population, firstly. And secondly, they believed the Assad regime was non-ideological to its core, and that therefore Bashar's alliance with Iran, it was believed, was fairly tenuous, and therefore he could quite easily, if only the correct inducement was offered, could quite easily be sort of tempted back from the Iran-led alliance to the US-led alliance. It was my belief, and often stated, that this entire view is an absolute lot of nonsense, and that the more or less opposite was the case. And it would seem to me, at least, that this has been vindicated. In other words, Assad is not all that weak, firstly. And secondly, his alliance with Iran has proven to be something of a stroke of genius, at least from his point of view. As I tried to outline before, it's the reason why he's still in power. Now, most people in the policy-making elite in Israel also think that nowadays, I'm happy to say. I don't wish to sound arrogant. I'm usually wrong on most things, but on this area I happen to get it right. And what it means is that the public pronunciations of both Defense Minister Ehud Barak and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are reflected in the views which one hears when speaking to senior people in the country, which is that they hope very much now for the rapid fall of Bashar Assad. The main reasons for their hoping this are not necessarily humanitarian. However, having said that, certainly any normal human being would be horrified at what Assad has been up to over the last year, but are centrally based on strategic considerations. Israel believes, and correctly, I think, that if Assad were to fall, this would be a very, very major blow to the Iran-led regional axis in the region, which in their view, and also correctly in my view, constitutes the main danger both to Israel's security and to the Western interest in the region as a whole. Assad falls, it means that the contiguous line of states that the Iranians want to construct west of their own border, Iraq, Syria, and then Lebanon, all the way to the Mediterranean Sea, would be interrupted. And this would be a major blow to the regime, which would also then be isolated from its most important client, the Hezbollah organization that controls Lebanon. So this is the Israeli consideration as it currently stands. and as it has developed and changed. And just lastly, of course, to reiterate the point that you also made, which is that Israel may have this consideration, but Israel is basically, as a country, is in essence in the same position as someone like me or any of us, as civilian analysts and observers. Namely, its position vis-a-vis Syria is that of spectator, and it has no ability to intervene in any of this. And I can tell you also, with some background knowledge, that where there have been occasions over the last year where some Syrian opposition elements, specifically some of those emerging from the Syrian Kurdish community, have wanted to try to establish some sort of communication with Israeli official circles, with the idea that perhaps they could gain some support from them, have met with resounding and total silence from the Israeli authorities, probably very prudently, in my view, on their part.
Thanks. So there's a question down there, then we go to here. There is an idea, yes.
Would you mind giving your opinion on the benefit or the lack of sanctions against both Iran and Syria?
Question about the benefit or lack thereof of sanctions.
Against both Iran and Syria, you ask. Well, the answer is relatively similar, I would say, in both cases. If we can focus on Syria, the sanctions have hurt the regime without a doubt. There are those who report that it is down to its last $4 billion in reserves. So you know, things are getting a little bit precarious in that respect, and undoubtedly the currency has been massively devalued, the loss of the ability to trade in oil, the collapse of the tourism sector, all of these have hurt the regime. So if the aim of the sanctions is to hurt the regime, the sanctions hurt, mission accomplished. But of course the sanctions aren't just intended to hurt Bashar al-Assad for the fun of it, they're intended to hurt him and then produce a desired policy result, namely either his departure or conceding to a reform process. Neither of those have happened. Neither of those are on the horizon as a result of sanctions, in my estimation. Why? Because it's a cost-benefit analysis, and of course different regimes do their cost-benefit math differently to other regimes. And Bashar Assad is not really in business for the benefit of his people, of the 22 million inhabitants of Syria. Rather, he's in business for the benefit of himself and his family. He and his family remain, of course, living lives of luxury, whether or not the tourism and oil sectors collapse or not. He cares mostly about power, and his power is not threatened by the sanctions. So the sanctions can inflict pain upon Syria, and they have done so. They have not, and in my view, they cannot produce the desired policy result, which they want to produce, because of the nature and thinking of the regime and the man who they wish to influence. Bashar Assad is simply not amenable to being persuaded because of economic hardships inflicted upon his population. I would say, don't want to get too much into Iran because I'd like to stay on the focus of our discussion, but it seems to me that this same set of considerations apply with regard to Iran. Again, you can hurt Iran. The sanctions have hurt Iran. The Iranians are clearly sitting up and taking notice of the sanctions. In my opinion, that's why the talks in Baghdad, the recent talks about on the nuclear issue in Baghdad, were able to happen, because the Iranians have been hurt by the sanctions. But once again, if anybody believes for a moment, and I advocate no policy on Iran here and Iranian nuclear questions, but if anybody believes for a moment that economic sanctions are going to be sufficient to make this Iranian regime and the rising forces within it abandon their nuclear ambition, that person, in my estimation, is dreaming. It's not going to happen.
Aya.
Bashar Assad's father, Hafez, emasculated the Muslim Brotherhood and indeed murdered thousands of its members. How powerfully are they now reconstituted, and what support are they getting from Egypt, where the Brotherhood is very strong?
Mm. Yeah, very.
Slightly repeat that question because there's a bit of noise out the back.
Sure. The question was regarding the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, and the questioner noted that Bashar's father Hafez decimated the Muslim Brothers in the early 80s, and she asked the extent to which they are receiving support from Egypt and outside of the country, and the extent of support which they have. The answer is, just to make it clear to people who perhaps don't know the history as well as we who spend too much of our time on it. There was an uprising by the Muslim Brothers against the Assad regime, the regime of Bashar's father, Hafez Assad, in the period 1979 to 1982. And this uprising ended in spectacular Assad fashion in 1982, when the president's brother, Bashar's uncle, one Rifat Assad, who by the way now lives in Switzerland because he failed to overthrow Bashar, but that's another story, led his independent armoured brigade to the uprising centre in the town of Hama in central Syria and smashed it to the ground with the deaths of between 20 to 30,000 people. That was the end of the first Muslim Brothers uprising. Hama, of course, has become synonymous for students of the Middle East and others for a certain approach to internal political problems that's popular in the Middle East. It wasn't the end of the repression of the Muslim Brothers. The organization was declared illegal. Membership of Muslim Brotherhood in the Syrian law statute is punishable by death. It's a capital crime. Which meant that, unlike in Egypt, where the only properly organized political force on the ground, other than the armed forces, was the Muslim Brotherhood, in Syria, the Muslim Brotherhood is not organized on the ground. The equivalent of in Egypt, where you have Muslim Brotherhood cells in town after town throughout the Sunni areas of the country, just isn't there in Syria. In Syria, the security structures were sufficiently stringent to prevent that from happening, which meant that, and means that, the Muslim Brothers do not possess an available infrastructure on the ground in Syria for them to move into and take possession of. That's not there. It should also be noted, and this is of crucial importance in looking at Syria, that unlike Egypt or Libya or Tunisia, for that matter, Syria is a very ethnically diverse country, and only around 60 to 65% of the population are Sunni Arab Muslims. That's to say, only about 60 to 65% of the population are available, so to speak, as potential supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood. Nobody who isn't a Sunni Muslim Arab is going to support the Muslim Brotherhood. So they're already a much more limited possibility. And even within that 60 to 65%, I would say, with some, and many others would I think agree, you know, there are a large number of quite genuinely secular Arab nominal Sunni Muslims in Syria. It was one of the most secularized of Arab countries, which means that the support base for the Muslim Brothers, it would seem to me at least, we can't measure these things because of the things I mentioned earlier, but it would seem to me at least is among the lowest in any of the Arabic-speaking countries. Thus far then, with regard to up to the uprising's beginning. As a result of a number of mistakes made by the US administration, and let me call a spade, the Muslim Brotherhood have been allowed to exponentially increase their influence in Syria and in the Syrian opposition since the uprising began. How has this taken place? First of all, because of the administration's attempt last year, at the beginning of the uprising, to contract out the creation of the Syrian political opposition. To who? To their favourite Middle Eastern government, that of Erdogan in Turkey. Now, it shouldn't be difficult to understand that if you give a Sunni Islamist government the job of creating a political opposition, what you will get is a Sunni Islamist political opposition. Right? That's not that's easy. Yeah, even obvious. That indeed is what has happened. When the Syrian National Council was created on Turkish soil, it was immediately noted there was a preponderance of Muslim Brothers in its leading elements. These had not been elected by anybody. It wasn't that there was elections in Syria and they elected the Muslim Brothers. It was that Erdogan likes the Muslim Brothers for obvious reasons. So when he created the opposition, he made sure, firstly, that there was no nationalist Kurds among them, for obvious reasons, and secondly, for equally obvious reasons, there was lots and lots of Muslim Brothers. So in the political opposition, the Muslim Brothers, because of mistaken Western policy, are punching well above their weight, with, I think, very negative potential consequences. And we are now seeing a similar process happening with the armed opposition. Because at the risk of sounding boring, nobody should be surprised if you want to create an armed insurgency in an Arab country and you contract out the job to Sunni Muslim religious governments, that you will get a Sunni Islamist armed insurgency. Well, the people who've been given that job are Saudi Arabia and Qatar. Right? So nobody should be surprised that the Muslim Brothers are also there in Antakya giving out money and giving out weaponry to Syrian rebel representatives who turn up in Antakya touting their particular little bit of the insurgency, with the result that the Muslim Brothers are managing to exponentially gain influence in the very chaotic and confused lines, network of lines of supply of arms and money to armed rebels. As the Muslim Brothers, to finish this point in a couple of sentences, the Muslim Brothers did not begin the Syrian uprising with a great number of advantages. But thanks to their own shrewdness and ability, plus the mistakes made by Western policy vis-à-vis the uprising, they are now punching well above their weight, and they are now very, very visible, both in the political and in the military elements of the uprising, which is taking on an increasingly sectarian and Sunni Muslim character.
Okay, so we'll go there, and there. Yeah? And a bit of a view. Okay.
Thank you very much for an exceptional talk in terms of its detail, accuracy, and objectivity. And I speak as somebody who really is on the opposite side. I feel that in the same way that Israel has possibly shot itself in the face by its settlement policy in the West Bank, similarly, in this situation, even though Syria is clearly the support line from Iran to Hezbollah, but rather than the enemy you know, you may end up with a Sunni majority in Syria, which is ultimately much more hostile to the existence of Israel.
We don't have a lot of time, so this
My question. Do you think that that is a possibility?
Mm-hmm. Forgive me, or I hope you understand if I don't respond on the issue of settlement policy in Israel, because we're not here to discuss that. That's all right with you. With regard to Syria, I'll tell you, this is an issue which is raised, and I hope you'll forgive me again by saying I think raised as a possibility with a certain amount of glee by people who don't like Israel very much. Let me respond in the following way. I don't personally believe that the fall of Assad will produce a regime more dangerous to the state of Israel than the current one, and I'll tell you why. Not because I think that the Sunni rebels against Assad are fond of Israel. They're not, although having been embedded with them for a week, I can tell you, you perhaps might be quite surprised at some of the things they say about Israel. Certainly what they do when Israel comes up is say Israel's much, much less bad and much, much less repressive than our so-called Arab brothers. And that's quoting directly from FSA fighters who are personal friends of mine who I care very much about. But they don't like Israel, of course not, and they certainly would not move out of the way of mainstream Arab policy on Israel should they come to power. Having said that, my own sense is that the Sunni Arab world, unlike the pro-Iranian bloc, has within it a great deal of pragmatism, or we could call it hypocrisy, with regard to Israel and the West. If we think of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Turkey also, even to a great extent, we can see immediately a very large gap between rhetoric and policy. On a rhetorical level, Saudi Arabia is the most anti-Israel, indeed the most anti-Jewish regime probably in existence on the planet, including the Islamic Republic of Iran. On a policy level, Saudi Arabia is entirely tied in because of its dependence on the West for its protection, with US-led security structures in the region, and indeed with Israel, because it shares a common fear of Iran, and there's much evidence out there in the public sphere that the Saudis and Israelis find it very easy to cooperate with one another behind the scenes when Iran is the issue. Which means, it seems to me, that should a Sunni government come to power in Syria, it will come to power within that sphere, and not within the other sphere. The genuinely dangerous, genuinely anti-Western, genuinely politicidal element in the region, which means what it says, and where there is no gap between policy and rhetoric, is that, I would contend, of the Shia-led bloc represented by Iran, Assad in Syria, Hezbollah, Islamic Jihad among the Palestinians and the others. The Sunni Arab bloc is a quite different state of affairs. So if a Sunni government comes into being in Syria, it seems to me it will be almost inevitable that it will be part of that sphere and not part of the other. It will be Saad Hariri rather than Hassan Nasrallah, and I'm sure you understand what I mean by that. You know, it'll be somebody who certainly, if asked, will say, I'm not fond of Israel, Zionists, and perhaps not even Jews very much, but that will have no policy implications for Israel. When Nasrallah says it, It clearly does. And that, it seems to me, is the key difference to be drawn here.
Question, Tom, yes.
Jonathan, could you give us an idea of the asymmetry of the situation there, perhaps the ratios of financial support for rebels versus the Assad regime, and also the numbers in their armed forces?
Yeah.
Any other indicators that you can think of?
Well, in terms of financial support for the rebels is impossible to gauge right now. There are no reliable figures. We know that money is coming in from Saudi Arabia and from Qatar. Just how much is very, very hard. With regard to how much is coming in for the regime, well, the figure I've heard is that over the last year, the Iranians have made a gift of up to $2 billion to the regime. What happens is that the Russians don't give the arms to the regime for free. These ships that are coming from southern Ukraine to Tartus are not carrying donations of weaponry. Iran gives the money to Syria, and Syria then pays for the Russian arms using Iranian money. So large amounts of Iranian money are coming in, and the arms are continuing to be sold. I also hear that the regime has a current overdraft, so to speak, of $4 billion in Russian arms purchases. That's to say, it has a debt of $4 billion outstanding on Russian arms. So it hasn't yet paid for a great deal of what it's receiving. In other words, it's getting free cash from the Iranians and arms on credit from the Russians right now to keep itself going. With regard to the interesting question of the balance of available forces, once again, I'll attempt to answer it because I do have some figures, but I would, before giving them, sort of advise caution, because, of course, it's very difficult to gauge exactly who's telling the truth or who's being a bit optimistic in their claims. What we can say with certainty, and this is clear and publicly available, is that the Syrian Arab Army, Assad's army, on paper, has 220,000 men and should be able to call on a further 280,000 reserves. Of course, in practice, Assad has nothing like that number of troops to call on because of the amount of desertions that have taken place. And there are the most recent claim I've heard is that Assad has around 70,000 loyal men, so to speak, who he can call on and really call on to defend his rule. Again, with regard to the rebels, it's even harder because they make quite grandiose claims about the number of men available to them. I mean, you can hear them talking about 75,000 fighters and so on. The most generous estimates of rebel soldiers I've heard are between 20 and 30,000 people available, and there are those who would say that there may be even as little as 10,000 people in the Free Syrian Army at the present time. It should be understood that while the Syrian Arab Army is hemorrhaging soldiers who desert, many of the soldiers who desert, perhaps quite sensibly one could argue in the circumstances, go home. They don't go to join the Free Syrian Army, they go home to sit this out. Only some of them go to join the Free Syrian Army. Having said that, if one looks at the Free Syrian Army, and I was looking at them fairly closely not too long ago, there are a large number of civilian volunteers in the FSA to make up that number. Not all of the FSA are army deserters. Many of them are just civilians who at a certain point have decided, okay, well, I think I'm going to take up arms against the Assad regime because I think it's a disgusting set of affairs that can't go on, or whatever else. So the figures are disputed, and I would say that the figure of between 20,000 to 30,000 is probably believable.
The asymmetry is huge.
Not only in terms of numbers, also in terms of numbers, but most importantly, I would say, also in terms of weaponry available. You know, the 4th Armoured Division, when it goes through Idlib province, as it did in February, in late February and March 2012, you know, if one wants to picture it or imagine it, this is a force that has T-72 and T-80 Russian tanks. It has helicopter gunships. It has artillery. It has all that to soften up the area in question before the Shabiha paramilitary people go in to do what they know how to do against the civilian population. The Free Syrian Army can't remotely, you know, oppose that frontally. It has no artillery, of course, no helicopter gunships, no armour. For the most part, from what I saw at least, and this is, others have verified this, it has automatic weapons, and it has a number of RPG-7s, which, by the way, I'm sure people, there are many here, I'm sure, who know weaponry better than I, but even I know that RPG-7s are no use against the modern reactive armor of the latest Russian tanks that the 4th Armored Division is using. So the RPG-7 looks good, and it can go through a wall, but it can't take out a Syrian, one of Assad's tanks. So yeah, the asymmetry in numbers and the asymmetry in weaponry are enormous.
So we're getting close to the end, so we've got the last two questions. Got to be very quick. One there, and then we end with Stuart. Yep. Simon.
How on earth have the minority Alawite regime been able to keep control or keep on side the Ba'ath Party, both Bashar Assad and his father, all these times? I understand the Ba'ath Party, the biggest, is also majority Sunni by far. How have they been able to keep them on side, and is there any possibility of making trouble there?
Question: how did the minority regime keep everyone else away?
Particularly
the Ba'ath Party. And the Ba'ath Party, for people who may not know, is the ruling party, of course, in its name. The Assad family rules Syria, has, I think, around 3.5 million members, so-called, in Syria today. The answer is, how have they been kept in line? Well, the Ba'ath Party in Syria, you won't be surprised to hear, you know, long ago ceased to be a party that one joins because of an idealistic belief in the nationalist theories of Michel Aflach and Salah al-Din al-Bitar. No disrespect to their theories. You join the Ba'ath Party in Syria today and for the last 40 years because you want to advance the well-being of yourself and your family. You know, once the Assad regime was in place, the Ba'ath Party effectively became a tool for the doling out of patronage. So the people who are involved in the Ba'ath Party today are involved because joined it in order to receive patronage. That is to say, they became part of one of the outer circles of of those benefiting from the regime. The Alawis, the Assad family itself, the Alawi families around it, were the top beneficiaries, the inner circle. But these people were an outer circle, and I think it's unlikely that the outer circle will desert the regime. I think also because we've reached a stage now in the Syrian uprising where anybody who is closely associated with the regime, including through Ba'ath Party membership, may well do the math and think to him or herself, well, I've got nothing to lose now, because if the regime goes down, I'm going to have to pay a very heavy price, so I may as well stick around with them. And that seems to be a dynamic which I think is happening. Let me just briefly respond to I think the larger question that was inherent in your question regarding how on earth did this little minority, the Alawi minority, manage to dominate Syria for so long. And the answer is, it is an absolute historical anomaly. But what happened was, in very brief terms, that the French, when they ruled Syria, in the way that the British and other colonial powers knew how to do, privileged minority communities and involved minority communities in military activity. And so the Alawis disproportionately were represented in the Syrian army, in the officer corps, when independence happened. Which means that when the Ba'ath Party began to recruit military cadres to its organization, there was a disproportionate number of Alawi military activists. And at a certain point, these military activists looked at the civilian leadership of the Ba'ath Party and said, remind me exactly why you're the ones giving me orders, why I shouldn't be the one there. And you can imagine what followed. The officers themselves came to power, and it happened to be that many of these officers were Alawis. They took power not as Alawis. They rule not because they are Alawis. They rule because they've managed to impose a monopoly of force and terror on the country. But in doing so, they've created, a very anomalous situation in which a minority rules over a majority in the Arab world. Interesting to note that the other example of Ba'ath rule in the Arab world, the late and unlamented Saddam Hussein regime in Iraq, was an example of exactly the same thing. Through the Ba'ath Party, through the rhetoric and through the use of terror, enabled a minority in Iraq, Sunni Arabs, to rule over a majority in Iraq, Shia Arabs. So in both cases, the Ba'ath has served as a strange fig leaf for rule by a minority through the extensive use of political terror.
Donald, very lastly, if what you say, the civil war was to continue into 2013, and Mitt Romney was to win the presidential election in the United States, do you think the policy of the United States would change?
It's very hard to predict, of course. My sense is that it might well. The fact of the matter is that if Romney wins, I think US-Middle East policy will change quite substantively. We know that it changed as a result of Obama taking over from George W. Bush very significantly. You know, the president of the USA is an important job, and it means something who's holding it. And everything which I hear from Romney's team or from people who've been meeting with Romney's team of Middle East advisors suggest that his policy would be very different, and I suspect might well involve a much more proactive support for Syrian rebels and for the downfall of the Assad regime.
Many thanks. Just to come over here.
Yeah.
There are many more questions if we can go on for a lot longer, but we don't. We have a rule of finishing on time, so I just want to be very brief. I think it's been a great night tonight, very informative. I've learnt a lot. I think we've all learnt a lot. We're very grateful to Jonathan Orkin and the Australia-Israel Jewish Affairs Council for bringing the speaker here, and to Jonathan Speier for a lively, informative, but most of all considered and cautious assessment of what is a tragic civil war. So we're very grateful to come in here tonight. Your speech will be up on our pod tomorrow. Paper will be published by Anne in due course in the Sydney papers. Channel 648 is here. So well done tonight, and thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.